Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Terrorism-Related Detention and Civil Rights Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On January 18, 2017, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Ziegler v. Abbasi, which was consolidated with the cases Ashcroft v. Abbasi and Hasty v. Abbasi. Ziegler v. Abbasi was part of a series of lawsuits brought by Muslim, South Asian, and Arab non-citizens who were detained after the terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001, and treated as of interest in the ensuing government investigation. These plaintiffs contended, among other things, that the conditions of their confinement violated their constitutional rights to due process and equal protection. The defendants included high-level officials in the Department of Justice, such as Attorney General John Ashcroft, FBI Director Robert Mueller, and Immigration and Naturalization Service Commissioner James Ziegler, as well as various detention officials. Some of the parties reached settlements, and the district court eventually dismissed some of the allegations against the DOJ officials for failure to state claim. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit affirmed the lower court's dismissal of plaintiffs' free exercise claims, but otherwise reversed most of the district court's judgment. Plaintiffs, the Second Circuit held, had adequately pleaded claims for violations of substantive due process, equal protection, the Fourth Amendment, and civil conspiracy, and defendants were not entitled to qualified immunity. Defendants then sought, and the Supreme Court granted, a petition for writ of certiorari. The questions now before the Supreme Court are threefold. One, whether the Second Circuit, in finding that plaintiffs' due process claims did not arise in a new context for purposes of implying a remedy under Bivens v. Six Unknown Named Agents of Federal Bureau of Narcotics, erred by defining context as too high a level of generality. Two, whether the Second Circuit erred in denying qualified immunity to defendant Ziegler. And three, whether the Second Circuit erred in holding that plaintiff's Fourth Amendment claim met the pleading requirements identified by the Supreme Court in its 2009 decision in Ashcroft v. Iqbal. To discuss the case, we have Jamil N. Jaffer, who is Adjunct Professor of Law and Director of the Homeland and National Security Law Program at the Antonin Scalia Law School. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Jaffer.
So today we'll be talking about the case of Ziegler v. Abbasi. It's actually three combined cases involving James Ziegler, the former commissioner of INS, John Ashcroft, the former attorney general, and another case, Hasty v. Abbasi, involving two of the individuals who ran the Metropolitan Detention Center in New York. The defendants in this case are senior federal government officials as well as two jailers who were involved in the aftermath of 9/11, and the plaintiffs are Muslim men of both Middle Eastern and South Asian extraction who've brought a claim that they were held unlawfully and under adverse conditions of confinement in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. And the claim here is fundamentally a claim for money damages against principally federal officials. And the claim is that these individuals, these federal officials, engaged in a policy of, or entered into a policy of detaining these men unlawfully and in these highly restrictive conditions. Now, what is clear, facts of the case, are that these men were held. They were immigration violators, who some of whom had suspected ties to terrorism, others of whom did not. There were essentially two lists of individuals. There was an INS list and a New York list. The INS list had been vetted down to folks who had specific ties to terrorism, and therefore under existing case law and practice could be held under restrictive conditions of confinement. The New York list, which is a list made by the New York FBI and INS offices, did not differentiate between folks that had ties to terrorism but who did not have ties to terrorism, but simply had immigration issues, but were being held under this overall rubric of a hold-until-cleared policy, essentially to research these individuals, make sure there were no issues, and then release them over time. These lists were handled differently at times and handled similarly at times. And so at the Metropolitan Detention Center in New York, where some of these detainees were held, the individuals were held under fairly restrictive conditions, whereas in the other facility in New York, I believe upstate New York, individuals were held under both some under restrictive and some under non-restrictive conditions. And so the complaint of these individuals is that the policy of merging the two lists, which they claim was a policy, and again, this case is at the pleading stage, so we take the facts as given in the complaint, whether those facts are sufficient to state a claim under the Supreme Court's prior case law in a very similar case, Ashcroft v. Iqbal, where the Supreme Court indicated that you had to have plausible claims against defendants to go forward under this sort of a theory. And so under the Supreme Court's more restrictive holding of what pleadings require, the question is, do these plaintiffs state a claim? And even if they do, do the federal officials get out under qualified immunity because the law was not clearly established as to their conduct? And so those were the issues at stake before the Supreme Court. And one larger meta issue I should mention, which is, can you have a Bivens damages remedy in a case like this involving, as the government put it, sensitive national security and immigration policy decisions, the immediate aftermath of a terrorist attack? And a Bivens damages remedies are a judge-made, a judiciary-made remedy that allows damages against federal officials, money damages against federal officials for constitutional violations. As for damages against state officials for constitutional violations, there's a federal statute, 1983, which permits money damages against state officials. However, on the federal side, the damages remedy is a remedy created by the courts to allow for money damages. In theory, the idea being behind these money damages being that you can deter bad conduct going forward if, in fact, the law is clearly established and a reasonable federal official would have known that their conduct would violate such law, and therefore you can go forward on the theory. Now, again, the case important for a variety of reasons, but really important because the question is will there be a heightened pleading standard or a different view on pleadings going forward in terms of plausibility, and will this case set new law as Iqbal did and tighten the law down on pleadings? Second, will Bivens damages be allowed for high-level policy decisions made by senior decision-makers in the government? And if so, will that chill policymaking in the future going forward by senior-level officials because of the availability of money damages? You know, and interestingly, this case, you know, these events took place in the immediate aftermath, the immediate months after 9/11. It's now nearly 15 years later, more than 15 years later, and of course, here we are still debating, approximately 15 years later, still debating these cases. And so, you know, a real potential chilling effect in long-term litigation costs and challenges for these defendants. And then finally, you know, the question whether these individuals, in fact, should enjoy qualified immunity because they could not have known at the time that this policy decision, as implemented in terms of restrictive conditions at the Metropolitan Detention Center in New York, would then have been levied against people they didn't necessarily know were on these lists. Again, we have to take the facts as granted in the complaint, and then ultimately whether they would have known that those actions and the restrictive conditions of confinement, which would have otherwise been lawful as against the detainees individually suspected of terrorism, whether that in fact subjects individuals to liability or at least allow the case to go forward past the pleading stages and escapes and gets past qualified immunity to allow these defendants to be held liable. So that was the stage we faced. That was where we stood. The decision below allowed the claim to go forward, and so the question before the court was would it reverse the lower court? And what was interesting about that oral argument was that the court was quite shorthanded. Obviously, as everyone knows, with the unfortunate passing of Justice Scalia, the court is down one member as it stands, with 8 members on the court now. We hear that apparently in the next week or so, the president will announce his nominee to replace Justice Scalia on the court. But notwithstanding that, in the confirmation process, the court is shorthanded as it stands. And in this case in particular, oral argument was even more shorthanded because two of the justices, Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan, were both recused from the case, ostensibly because they had some involvement in the matter or related matters in their prior time in government. So the court in this case had oral argument down to 6 members from the 8 that are currently sitting on the court. And so, for the plaintiffs in this case, the Muslim males, what they would need, if you assume the court broke along what people believe are the ideological lines on the court, they would need to, even if they had gotten, if they were able to get Justices Ginsburg and Breyer, they'd still, in order to get a tie and to sustain the lower court's decision, they'd still need one of Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Thomas, Justice Kennedy, or Justice Alito. So I think the sort of the if you were a handicapper looking at this court, you were looking at some potentially tough sledding for the plaintiffs, even though in a typical scenario, all they would need to do is to get to a tie, and with Justice Sotomayor and Kagan on the sidelines, it made that a little more challenging for them to sustain the ruling of the lower court. So off we go to arguments, the case sort of began with the Solicitor General or the Assistant Solicitor General arguing, look, this is just like Iqbal. You all, the justices, have seen this case before. You've already said the plaintiffs can't state a claim. Their claims aren't specific enough. They're not detailed enough. And there's a plausible basis for there to have been a obvious non-invidious, that is, non-discriminatory basis for the decisions made by the defendants, that they were not motivated by racial or religious animus. But in fact, what they were concerned about was in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, when this policy was instituted in October of 2011, of 2001. You know, the concern was the mistaken release of an individual who could have had terrorist ties, and that they were doing everything they could to guard against that. So yes, while it's true, individuals who did not have suspected ties to terrorism were detained, and some of them, admittedly, were detained under restrictive conditions at the MDC in New York. The question is, you know, was that problematic? Given is there a plausible claim to be made that these high level Justice Department and INS officials and jailers acted with some sort of racial or religious animus? Is there an obvious and alternative explanation that doesn't comport with the facts alleged in the complaint that would prevent the claim from going forward because the allegations aren't specific and sufficient enough to actually state a claim? So, to be fair, I think that on that ground alone, there was some suspicion by the justices. There was a skepticism, I think, of the plaintiff's claims. Interestingly, the attorney for the plaintiffs, the attorney for the Muslim males, provided a very capable argument, and you know it's worth noting that she actually her grandparents or her great grandparents, Rachel Mirpal, her great grandparents were actually Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, who were ultimately executed for spying in a series of famous cases that came before the court. But she gave a very impassioned argument and a very credible argument, I think, for the plaintiffs. But I think ultimately, given the argument the way it went, there was a lot of skepticism about the claim. In particular, there was skepticism, I think, on the question whether the Bivens remedy, this judge-made remedy, which the court has repeatedly said is to be very carefully cabined, very carefully and not extended beyond its circumstances, except in rare circumstances where it's absolutely necessary to ensure proper conduct by federal officials and in particular people who either are involved in federal law enforcement activities or federal imprisonment activities. I think she faced a very stiff uphill battle there, making that claim that Bivens ought to be extended to this national security and immigration context, particularly with high-level policy decisions. Now, Ms. Mirpal made a strong argument, I think, that in fact, you know, this isn't really about national security and immigration policy. What was really going on here was that these defendants were engaged in a policy to ensure these people were mistreated and were held under very restrictive conditions because that was where they were in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, and that was their view. But at the end of the day, I think there's that in fact courts had previously held that you could impose Bivens remedies on federal officials for conditions of confinement, and that simply putting this in a national security context didn't change things, or putting this in a policy context didn't change things. At the end of the day, if the result is restrictive conditions of confinement, that's an available Bivens claim. So there's nothing new, no extension of Bivens needed here. But it seems, at least an oral argument from the recordings, that the court was skeptical of that claim, and that there were other remedies available to these defendants. That in fact the defense didn't only need to have money damage; that was their only way of recompense for this for these alleged constitutional violations. That in fact they could have sought habeas relief, and some in fact did seek habeas relief and were released from prison ultimately as a result of their habeas petitions. And so I think an uphill battle for the plaintiffs at the end of the day, but a very interesting case, an important case, one that I think will guide future courts generally in the case of what you need to do in terms of pleadings and obviousness and viability of claims going forward. And then in the more specific context of national security and immigration cases, the question of the Bivens remedy being extended and the other related questions we talked about.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.fedsoc.org/multimedia.